Welcome to Office Hours with John Gardner. The John N. Gardner Institute for Excellence in Undergraduate Education strives to advance higher education's larger goal of achieving equity and social justice.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Office Hours with John Gardner. I am John Gardner, and I'm continuing my Socratic search for good people, good minds, good ideas, and particularly their practice of innovation. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Denise Bartel, who is a senior academic leader in the Office of the Chief Academic Officer at Kent State University. And I want to mention a couple of connections I have with Dr. Bartel. One is just to her university, Kent State. Kent State had a tragedy in 1970, which maybe a few of you remember. There were four students that were shot by Ohio National Guard troops there, the students who've been involved in a protest action against the American war in Vietnam, of which where I had been on active duty during that period. It was very close to me. And that event, Dr. Bartel, at your current employer, was the stimulus for a demonstration that turned into a riot the following week at the University of South Carolina, which led to really the foundation of my career, because that riot led my president to convene a faculty panel to try to analyze and understand why we had this student riot and what could we do about student hostility. And the answer we came up with was, and I hope people think I'm making this up because I'm not, it was to teach students to love the university. We thought if they love the university, they wouldn't riot and trash it. So there's an important connection between my guest's university and my university. And I also learned because we're doing this on the Zoom platform, she has a backdrop, which is quite lovely. And I asked her what it was, and she told me it was a picture of the Arboretum at her alma mater, Cornell University. Another connection to my work, one of Cornell's most distinguished alumni, Charles Feeney, founded the foundation known as the Atlantic Philanthropies. And he died just a couple of months ago, but very much in his life, about 20 years ago, he gave the Gardner, his foundation gave the Gardner Institute $2 million to further our work. And this is a really unique person in the history of philanthropy, because he was very, very successful, but his goal was to give away all his money before he died. And that's a connection to our guest. Mr. Feeney's, I'm noting, for his generosity. And our guest today is also very generous with her colleagues and with her students. And I first learned about my guest today when I was invited to read what we have to do in the academic world in the faculty life. I had to do this. And Dr. Bartel had to do this. When she was being considered for the highest level professor, she had to, in effect, put together a dossier on her life's work. And I noticed then something about herself that she has put in a phrase, and I'd like to ask her to talk about this. The way she represented the innovative work she'd been doing at the University of Toledo was an integration of what she calls the personal of an innovator being interwoven into the profession. And that really spoke to me. So our guest today has experience in several of the most common type of universities that we have, which are regional comprehensive public universities that enroll close to 5 million students. And in her case, her university, both the universities she's worked in recently, are in a state with significant declining demographics and a dramatic change in the college-going population, which is posing all kinds of challenges for innovation. So with that, I would like to welcome Dr. Bartel, you're probably wondering, are you ever going to speak? And yes, you're going to speak for the rest of this, what will be a conversation. Now, I've given you an introduction, and I'd like you now to introduce yourself in any way you deem appropriate, okay? What should our listeners and thinkers, our searchers for good ideas, what should they know about you initially?
Well, thank you, John, and thank you for the invitation to be here. It's really an honor, and I'm going to do my best to represent well the work that I've done and the people that I have done it with. What should folks know about me? I think maybe to start professionally, I started on a fairly traditional academic path. I was an assistant professor, starting at one of the regional campuses of the University of Wisconsin system at UW-Green Bay, coming out of a graduate program in human development and family studies. And I knew when I was in graduate school fairly quickly, as soon as I got into the classroom, that I wanted to pursue a career focused on undergraduate education. And I wanted to be at a place that valued that work. I was really fortunate, to be able to land at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay because it was such a place. And I had a tremendous opportunity to learn from colleagues, to learn from my students, and to do things that I probably wouldn't have if I had been at a bigger institution. Within the first few years of me getting there, I was approached by a colleague who was interested in creating first-year seminar courses as a result of going to the National Conference on the First-Year Experience the last year, invited me and a small other group of faculty to participate in the next conference. I went. I actually participated, John, in your and Betsy's all-day workshop introducing it. And I think it did change the course of my career because I was able to work with this small group of colleagues to create a first-year seminar program that I frankly think is a model for how to do this work well. It was integrating first-year information, how to college, with these sort of exciting content-based interdisciplinary courses. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the next 5 or 6 years, I had opportunities, as I saw needs, to start developing things like peer mentoring programs for that first-year seminar course. I was able to develop with colleagues, including staff and students, something called the GPS program, the Gateways to Phoenix Success in Green Bay, which was basically an intensive first-year learning community for students who've been historically underserved by higher education.
What do you mean by learning community in that sense?
It was really, we kind of started to refer to it as a self-honors program. And so it was a bundle of tips. It was a series of courses over the first year taught by a faculty mentor who served as a mentor for a small group of students who took these courses together in a cohort over the first year, including one of these first year seminar courses, and also including courses on what it means to be a citizen in our country in the 21st century and the role that education plays. Their spring, they had a capstone project where this group of students working with the support of their faculty mentor, peer mentor, and an academic advisor who served as a mentor, planned and implemented a service project around a theme from their coursework in the fall. And so from start to finish, they designed these projects, and the projects were intended to support education and the mission of education as a public good in our community and on our campuses. And from that work, I learned that our students are remarkable. And they are capable of remarkable things if we create the conditions for them to be able to learn. And we expand our notion of what it means to be college ready and the kinds of capacities that support the ability to be successful. Those students, many of whom were conditionally admitted to our university, went on to be our graduating class speakers. They oftentimes participated in more high impact practices than students who were coming in with much higher high school GPAs from much more affluent school districts. They helped us to change the institution by becoming agents of change within it. And that was really, I think, an opportunity for me to learn about the tremendous power of community and about relationship. And I think I brought that learning with me as I went into the University of Toledo and took on a full-time administrative role and had the opportunity to participate in what was called the Student Experience Project. And this is a group of a coalition of six universities working with some of the leading social psychologists around the country who wanted to figure out how we could take some of those social psychological interventions on concepts like belonging and really integrate them into what ended up being the course experiences that our students were having, their curricular experiences. And again, it was working in community to develop these experiences for our faculty and learning about the tremendous power of faculty community for doing this work, which I think I had started to learn when I was in Green Bay, and it was just reinforced to me when I was in Toledo. And then about a year and a half ago, I had the opportunity to come to Kent State and really bring all of that learning to a place that is intensely student-centered, has, I think, a real commitment to serving our region. And so it was very exciting to me to come back to a place that had a strong regional system. And most recently, I've moved into a position that is wholly about supporting our seven campus regional system that serves an area that's about the size of the state of Connecticut. And students who, but for these campuses, probably not would not pursue any kind of post-secondary education, and supporting the faculty as well as the students who are serving on these campuses in our system.
I'm originally from Connecticut, and but after getting sent to South Carolina in the Vietnam War, I ended up as vice chancellor for the regional campuses of the University of South Carolina, and didn't have seven. I had five dispersed throughout the state of South Carolina. And that is a very unique aspect of American higher education, how flagship research universities like yours and mine have reached out to serve in ways that they were originally not designed. Do you, I suspect most of our or many of our listeners don't know anything about regional campuses, higher education. Do you want to say any more about that?
I mean, if you look at who is serving most of our students in terms of access to four-year degrees, it is our regional public universities, our four-year universities and our two-year universities that are gateways into four-year degrees. Both in terms of numbers of population, but also in terms of who they serve, right? So our regional systems, our regional campuses are generally serving students who would not access higher education if their options were private four-year universities, right, or public flagships. And not necessarily because they couldn't gain admission to those schools, but oftentimes because they have a set of responsibilities that really center them in a particular community with their families. They're already working, which brings tremendous access with them into the educational experience. But our system of higher education is not necessarily designed to support those students.
Right. If you were to add up the enrollments on your seven regional campuses total and compare that to the total enrollment at your flagship Kent State University, how do they compare where your students have distributed themselves?
So we have about 5,300 to 6,000 FTE across our seven regional campuses. Now, because we have such a higher percentage of part-time students than typically main campuses do, that works out to about 8,000 unique students. some of those are CCP or college credit and high school students, right? So we are serving at this point approximately 25% of our student population are students who are in local high schools who are earning college credit.
Ohio is a real leader in this, yes.
Yeah, which is an absolute gateway into post-secondary education for those students. And so that's a really important part of our population. And that's compared to about 20,000 total students on the Kent campus. So it's a fairly large percentage of our undergraduate population.
So over 25% of your total enrollment then is regionally.
Yeah. Undergraduate.
Yeah, right. Undergraduate. Yeah. Yeah. Well, what, you know, I think you told us that, but would it be accurate to say that you discovered that you could do innovative work at Green Bay? Was that your first university after graduate school? Okay.
Yeah.
So you started right after graduate school then. You know, if we look at this as a continuum from Green Bay to Toledo to Kent State, where are you on the continuum? You know, what's your own, if the end were to be your total career, which you have not by any means completed, that's 100%. Where are you, do you think? Do you think you're at 50%, 60, 70 in your own development? Where do you think you are?
In my own development. Mm-hmm. I would probably say 50%. And I think that I say that because it sounds cliche, but the more you learn, the more you realize you need to learn. and I think that as I've gotten more deeply into this work and I've sort of started to understand more the system of higher education in which we work, and I think which is invisible in many ways to many of us, particularly those who have kind of been successful in the system enough to choose careers within it, mm-hmm. That there is a lot more to learn and frankly a lot more to accomplish. And so I think that I started my work with a real commitment to creating robust learning experiences for undergraduate students, and particularly those underserved by higher education. And as my career has developed, one of the things that I've realized is that in order to do that, we have to start working more effectively at higher levels of the system, particularly faculty, and the culture within institutions and the culture of higher education that frankly is designed to perpetuate existing systems of power and privilege. So basically makes it impossible.
Say that again, Denise. I want to make sure everybody heard that.
The system of higher, this is my belief, that the system of higher education that we are all working within was designed as a feature, not a bug, to perpetuate existing systems of power and privilege, mm-hmm. which is why we have such a difficult time achieving equity and outcomes for students and access for students and completion for students and even for those who complete in career success.
Now, is that what you meant when you said, maybe 2 minutes ago at the most, you used a very striking adjective, I thought, that's my judgment, to describe the system of higher education. You indicated that you eventually realized that the system was really invisible. I didn't stop you then, but I want our listeners to hear you talk about what you mean by invisible, and as well as expand on this notion of how the system perpetuates existing power and privilege to the disadvantage of a whole population. Can you do those two? Let's start with invisible.
So, you know, I think that by nature of the fact that those of us who work within higher education were successful enough within the system to complete our degrees right. and to get into jobs, we often don't see the barriers that are put up that make it more challenging for some students to be successful in this environment than others. And when I started this work, you know, I was looking at things like understanding higher ed speak, right? So helping students to translate the language that we use in higher education. What is a bursar? Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. What is a bursar's office? What are office hours? How do I speak to my instructor?
That's the name of this podcast series.
Right, because we realized that many of our students, particularly those who were the first in their family to go to college, interpreted office hours to mean the time during the day that we were in our office doing the important work, and so we were not to be disturbed.
Right, or they interpreted as going to the office meant punishment.
Neither of which really are conducive to developing those relationships with faculty that we know are so essential right. for student success and for student thriving. So it started that way. But then as my work progressed and I started to do things like develop emergency aid programs at Green mm-hmm. Bay, because I realized how many of our students were just sort of one problem away from dropping out of college. Developing early alert systems, I started to realize that we're working within a system that assumes that you have a particular level of financial resources, that assumes oftentimes explicitly that your only responsibility is school, mm-hmm. right? To the extent that sometimes our policies on things like academic probation say you know, with a sort of stern warning, you really need to now commit yourself to school fully, and it should be your primary responsibility. And that, you know, frankly, the work of education, particularly at the undergraduate level, is not valued in the system of higher education. And it's something that we don't really talk about, I think, as much as we should in those ways. So when I started to look at that, and I started
that's one of the purposes of this podcast series, talk about undergraduate education.
Like when I started to learn more and read books like Alexander Aston's Are You Smart Enough? Right. And realize that we have a system of higher education that is mainly about gatekeeping, right? And sorting students into groups of who has it and who doesn't, right? A very sort of fixed mindset approach that generally the students who have it are the ones who by the privilege of their birth had a set of resources that many of us did not have. And then I started to think about the way that we, the way that the value hierarchy in higher education. So if you look, for example, at spending per student, right? Orders of magnitude more at elite institutions, at public institutions, and then as you sort of go down that continuum, there is a direct correlation between the need of the student and the scarcity of resources that are spent on that student, right? So orders of magnitude, fewer dollars per student when you get down to a community college or even a regional public institution relative to the flagship, even though arguably those institutions really need more resources per student because the students at the flagship already are kind of coming in, right, with a set of resources that make it much more likely that they are going to be successful. We go through our graduate school training in PhDs, and if we're lucky, maybe we have a course on how to teach. And we spend 6 years learning how to do our disciplinary scholarship. And then we go out into the world and our worth as an academic is determined largely by the quality of the institution at which we can get a job if we are, you know, an academic and a faculty member, defined as where you can do the most research and the least teaching, in particular, the least undergraduate teaching. And then you look at who gets paid more or less within a particular institution. The more teaching you do, the less well you get paid. And we even use language like buying you out or releasing you from teaching responsibilities, right? And that's a privilege. And so at every level of our system, we are devaluing the work of teaching and we are elevating the worth of other things. And it just so happens, possibly not a coincidence, that those things help to perpetuate existing systems of power because they maintain limited access for those who have been underserved by higher education, and then limited outcomes for even those who are able to access and complete.
Are you writing about this?
Probably not as much as I would like to be at this point. You know, I will admit that one of the challenges for me personally is to be able to balance the work of, okay, you know, we need to support our faculty and do this institutional change and try to change the field and the work of finding the time to write about it. So I think I do a much better job of public dissemination, conferences, right? Speaking with groups of people than written dissemination at this point.
Well, you have plenty of time. You know, listening to you has evoked for me, it's not the first time I've thought about this, but when I listen to you talk, it's very obvious that your experiences at Green Bay were very, very formative for you. This is your first faculty job. And you talked about how you were given an opportunity to work with another colleague to develop something. And I've evoked for me my memories of my first, you know, early teaching experiences and how formative they were. So what does this say about what, if we really want to innovate and improve the student experience, what do we need to do to help professors? I was thinking of saying how you used to be. You're still the same person, but you're not an assistant professor. and it's not your first rodeo. But for example, in your current work for Kent State University, with the faculty on the regional campuses, when I was a regional campus vice chancellor, I spent an enormous time working on faculty development for faculty who were basically teaching beginning courses, not much in their of any depth in their discipline. But what are you doing, or are you spending time on something that obviously had a huge impact on you, which was your developmental experiences as a beginning faculty member?
Yes. So, and that's one of the things that I'm most excited about with my work here. But I think that one of the things that I think is so critically important, if we want to do this work and do it well, is that we have to center relationships and community. That we learn in relationship with others. We mm-hmm. build in community with others. And if we want to get to a place where higher education achieves its aspirational mission of kind of being for the public good, the only way we get there is in collaboration and relationship with others. And that is as true for the relationships that we need to form with our students, right? And I think that's why, you know, when I talk about my experiences at Green Bay, the relationships that I formed with colleagues, because it wasn't one colleague, it was dozens of colleagues sure. over mm-hmm. the course of 15 years, faculty and staff, but then also students, right? And really working as collaborators and co-creators with students, listening to the student voice, bringing them in leadership positions to this work that is being done to support them.
Yeah.
And doing it with a very explicitly relational orientation, which I'm so excited now. There are books on this, right? Relationship with education, et cetera.
But I have interviewed the three of the four co-authors of yeah. Relationship with Education
right.
for this podcast series. Leo Lambert, Peter Felton, and Issa Sarcevega. Yeah. So you're doing work in this field too.
I'm a relationship scientist by training. And so I see the world through relationships, but I understand that. And I increasingly understand that learning is learning. And so if we are trying to help our faculty grow in their abilities to effectively work with students, we need mm-hmm. to apply the same principles that we apply in our classrooms with our students. And the core of that is connection, being connected to a purpose associated with what you're doing and others who have a shared sense of purpose, who are working together collaboratively to do something bigger than just what they can accomplish on their own. And so that you can see in the work in GPS, I think that was really kind of the place where I recognized the tremendous power of those kinds of relationships at every level, right? The students who were in the program, what I learned from it, what our faculty and staff who were a part of the program learned. When we worked in Toledo in the Student Experience Project, I took some of what I had learned about the importance of those communities and started to really design more intentional communities of practice around relationships, right? And so essentially—
Elaborate on that, talk about that.
So we were in the Student Experience Project, as I mentioned, we were trying to develop and sort of utilize these evidence-based practices based on the research on belonging and growth mindset and self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the real world environment of the classroom using this sort of very innovative student pulse check survey where faculty were able to get real-time data from students on their sense of belonging, the extent to which they believe their instructor had a growth mindset about their capacities. And those were really, really important tools. And, you know, I realized and was able to work with a group of colleagues at Toledo who also understood this, that if we wanted faculty to not just utilize these practices in the one semester in the one course where they were part of this program, the best way to do that was to create a sense of community among them. Mm-hmm. And so we had this very, what I would consider to be intensive. We met every week for a week in small communities, and we talked about not just these practices and what we were seeing within our students, but we also talked about how difficult it was to do this work. Right. This is occurring wholly over the course of the pandemic.
And in the so are you saying that to do this work with students, we have to first do it with ourselves?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes. that we cannot create spaces of belonging for our students if we're not intentionally designing those spaces for our faculty, our staff, and even our leaders.
Yeah. Now, you described yourself as a, quote, relationship scientist. If you use that language in the academy, is that... I was listening to public radio last night, as I do every night. I was listening to a woman who's written a book on recent dating patterns. Is that going to, you know, is the message here? I'm struggling to ask you the question. How do you make palatable receiving, getting faculty who don't know anything about a discipline, a relationship, science, to understand that, no, this is not about writing dating self-help books. So I don't even know whether they ever think that. But how do you describe to your colleagues what it means to be a relationship scientist?
Yeah, so I think that that is getting easier. You know, I think a decade ago, I was a little bit more circumspect in the language that I used to describe the work that I was doing. And I focused more on what felt like more sanitized terms, like communities of practice. Mm-hmm. The language of belonging, right, and kind of creating mindset cultures has helped because, again, that, you know, it takes it out of the emotive. But there has also been an awful lot of really good work done on the connection between emotion and learning, right? And
yeah, you said it takes it out of the emotive, like that's a problem. That's something we shouldn't do.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I think is a barrier for us in higher education is the sort of rationalist, objectivist stance that we hold as sort of the highest level of the hierarchy of ways of knowing. And it's just not the reality of how humans work or learn. Mm-hmm. And so one of the joys of the last 2 years here at Kent State University is that when I got here and I sort of brought the learning from what we were doing at Toledo that we call the Equity Champions Community of Practice, and some colleagues and I have been working to try to help other universities develop models like this, but we're really clear that there's no one size fits all. And so what we do is we go to an institution, you know, there's a coalition of faculty and maybe some mid-level administrators who want to do this work. And then we help them figure out how to design a program that works for them, given their culture. Right. And given the needs of that institution. And here at Kent State, I was really privileged to be able to work with a group of faculty who, frankly, I think empowered me to lean in to what I had always believed, but was a little bit more hesitant to say, and which is that love is at the center of what we do.
Love is at the center of what we do?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know,
this is the day after, ladies and gentlemen, this is the day after Valentine's Day that I'm having this conversation.
It has nothing to do with what I'm talking about here, not the commercialization of human feeling. But I remember at one of my first FYE conferences, I heard Russell Lowry Hart mm-hmm. give a keynote presentation, and he was then the president of Amarillo College. And he said, out in the open to about 2,000 people, we must love our students.
I was in the room,
success,
I remember.
Right? Mm-hmm. We must love our students to success. Mm-hmm. If we don't love our students, how can we expect them to learn from us? Mm-hmm. And I thought he was incredibly brave. And also he became a bit of a role model for me that, like, if he can say that, right? And it's true. I know it's true, right? At the core of who I am, and in reading all of the research that I have about how learning works, I know it's true. And I came here and I was working with faculty who said, yes, that's what it is. We need to call it that. And, you know, and so now our program is really centered on this idea of what we call radical love, right? And radical hope. And we don't shy away from it. And we define it, we sort of operationalize it as
now, you're using those two terms, radical love and radical hope. You're using them publicly amongst your faculty colleagues at Kent State.
We are. And we're doing as much as we can to explain what we mean by this. Right. And we're talking about the fact that we learn in community and we learn.
This is what you need to be writing about, Dr. Bartel.
Well, you know, we're doing some really good work here. And so I hope that that I have some colleagues here who are doing this work with me, some really amazing faculty, and we're going to start doing this together. But we've got over 90 faculty this semester who are working in 7 different communities with 14 faculty facilitators, all within the regional system, who are talking in this way and are learning in this way. And one of the other things that we do, and I think this is really important, is, yes, it is, we have to center relationship and connection. It is a key, it's a key to systems level change. We also have to help, I'm going to use faculty in this case because we're talking about faculty, communities of transformation. We have to empower our faculty to better understand the system that they are working within, right? So unpacking a lot of the invisible things that I was talking about earlier, and that it is these two things, right? This sort of really helping us to understand the power of creating spaces where people feel like they belong and they are part of a community and they are supported, and doing so with an understanding that creating a sense of belonging in your classroom isn't going to fix all the problems, because we're working within a system of higher education that is designed to perpetuate inequity. And what this program is really intended to do is to empower faculty to be agents of change, because they are the most powerful tool that we have to change the system of higher education. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, I'm starting to think that it is a feature, not a bug, of the system that we do nothing to educate faculty, not just about teaching, but about how higher education works, how to use the levers of power at their disposal, you know, in ways that are effective, and how to do so collectively, and how to do so within your institutions, and how to do so within your disciplinary organizations, which makes it a lot easier to maintain the status quo, even with faculty who very much believe in the mission of education for social justice purposes. Mm-hmm.
I want to back up and ask you here. You started to explicate radical love and radical hope. And then you went on and you said that the focus on relationships is the key to system level change. Now, I really want our listeners to understand those three interrelated notions. So let's go back to radical love in the higher ed faculty, staff, student context, of course. What do you mean by radical love?
What I mean is that we have to care about our students. We have to care about their success. We have to care about their learning, right? This is not about making things easier, just passing every student, right? It is about respecting and valuing our students enough to create challenging learning conditions for them. Because otherwise, we're just gatekeeping. We're sorting the students, right, as Aston said, into the smart and not smart categories, right?
I think you're operationally defining here, which I appreciate, love. What is the adjective radical? How does that connect with it? Just because it's uncommon what you're espousing?
I think yes. I mean, I think that radical is a word that we're using because it is happening in the context of a system that really steps away from acknowledging emotion, right, in higher ed and academia, much less embracing it. And so it is radical, even in this day and age, to get up in front of a group of, you know, senior level leaders at your administration and talk about the fact that we have to love our students to success, and be able to explain that in a way that maybe opens the minds a little bit to thinking about things maybe a little bit different.
The president who offered me my first job to do any of this kind of work, I was only 28, and I was his third choice, not his first or second. And but his mantra was, we have to teach students to love the university. And if we could do that, they wouldn't riot like they did at Kent State and the University of South Carolina. And we've had no riots in 52 years, by the way, since we started teaching them to love the university. So I get that. You know, we can teach people anything we want to teach them. We can teach them to love. We can teach them to hate. We can teach them to kill. I learned how to kill and hate in the Air Force, okay, as well as heal. I was a psychiatric social worker. But I learned how to kill before they'd let me do that. But now what about radical hope?
Yeah. And you know, I just want to say that I think if we do a good job of loving our students to success, and creating conditions for them to develop meaningful relationships with each other and with us, faculty and staff, mm-hmm. then they love the university, right? But it's all occurring through relationship, right? That you don't love your university just because it's an Ivy League, right? Or a right. top 10. You love it because of how it made you feel. And how it made you feel is because of the relationships that you were able to form there. Radical Hope is, I basically take the frame that Kevin Gannon developed in that somewhat famous blog post that was 2014 or 2016 now, where it was, I think the blog post was called something like Radical Hope, a Teaching Manifesto. And he just laid out, you know, all of the ways in which we do things kind of predicated on the assumption that our students aren't capable, that they're going to game the system, right? That we sort of have a lack of hope about their capacity and a lack of belief in their capacity. And this was his commitment to do things differently. Mm-hmm. And it went viral. And I remember one of my colleagues sent it to me and we all read it and we sent it to each other and thought, wow, you know, this person is spot on. And so I think radical hope is a maybe more heartfelt way of framing what Mary Murphy calls mindset culture, right? Belief in people, right? And believing in people, believing people, right? So something as simple as if your student is telling you that something is going on in their life and they can't make it to class, believe them, mm-hmm. right? But it's also about believing that every student has the capacity to learn and grow. And having enough humility to understand that you can't assess accurately which student has which capacity. You have to create the conditions for them to be able.
You can't assess that initially, and therefore you have to assume that everybody has the potential to do it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, you have enough experiences with students who just blow you away mm-hmm. with what they are able to do right. and accomplish, that you start to realize very quickly that the algorithms you think you had in your head about which student is going to be successful in your research assistantship or in your right. internship is completely flawed. And that is really doing more harm than good sometimes in terms of your mission to educate students.
Somebody pointed out to me a couple of years ago, sent me a copy of my first class roster for the first time I taught University 101 at the University of South Carolina, asked me, did I recognize any of my students? And I remembered three of them, but I didn't remember one whose name I noted. It was a woman by the name of Darla Moore, who's one of my students. She's the only woman in the United States for whom an AACSB accredited school of business is named because of her enormous philanthropy in endowing the business school at the University of South Carolina. I had no idea what this woman was going to amount to in her life. I had a feel for what a few of them were, but she was an unknown to me. So boy, did I miss that. While we still have just a little time left, please come back. I hope our listeners are not tired of me getting you to repeat this, but I want to make sure they get this. You said that the focus on relationships is key to system level change. Hit us one more time with that.
Yeah. And, you know, it is hard and it is a long game, right? I think that particularly in the student success world, we very much want to do things like data analytics and early intervention systems and chatbots right. and see those as the, like, this is what we need. But it's not going to lead to systems level change if you're not also addressing the relationships on your campuses and in your institutions between everyone. I was listening to a podcast not too long ago that I just found incredibly inspirational. And one of the things that the person
said, I think people are going to say that about this one.
So it was Father Gregory Boyle. And mm-hmm. I think the podcast was 10% happier maybe. And he was talking about his work with gang members in the Los Angeles area. And he's created something called Homeboy Industries, which is truly remarkable. And he was talking about other people's approaches to kind of gang intervention. And he said, sometimes things work that don't help. Mm-hmm. But what helps always works. And so for me, if what we want is sustainable, real change in higher education, we have to start focusing on what helps and putting more resources in what helps. And, you know, and realizing that what works may not actually be helping us in the long run if it takes resources away from doing the hard work. And I think the hard work is the relationship. And relationships are the keys then to us really thinking critically about how we need to change the system of higher education to work for everyone.
So you're arguing that what really helps is this focus on building communities of faculty, staff, students around relationships. That's your argument.
Yes. And sometimes it's even a relationship, right? That students can have a dramatically different experience based on one relationship that they form, right, at an institution. And so, yes, it's community, but it really is relationship, it's connection, meaningful connections with others. Yeah.
Well, I have a feeling that after listening to this, we're going to have some listeners who'd like to try and make a meaningful connection, quote unquote, with you. And so how could they follow up with you and contact you?
Well, they can come find me at Kent State University. My email is just my my first initial D and then Bartell, B-A-R-T-E-L-L at kent.edu. If you Google me, you probably can find me relatively easily. And one of the things, you know, this is all about community and relationship. And so one of the things that I'm really excited about, and I think the work with Student Experience Project has allowed me to do, is to start thinking about how we can move this beyond the level of an institution and sort of really create a national movement that figures out how to better value the work of teaching and create the systems level change. And so anybody who is interested in doing that, understanding that I'm not exactly sure what that is at this point, I would love to connect with you and have conversations, because I know that there's so many people who are doing the same work.
Say that again. What are you soliciting contact about?
Anyone who wants to do this work, who believes in the power of connection and relationship, who wants to work on elevating the valuing of teaching in our system, and wants to work on changing the system to make it work more for all of our students, and who sees the power of connection and community and relationship in that work, and understands it's a long game, right? This is not a quick, it's not a chatbot solution. It's building relationships.
Not a technology solution.
It is not, unfortunately. I mean, technology is a tool in the toolkit, but it's not the solution. And, you know, every month I am connected with people who are passionate about this work and who are doing this work. So I know we're all out there. It's just that it's hard to find each other at this point.
Have you taken, you said you have interest in creating a national movement around this. Have you taken any preliminary steps?
Yes. And so one of the things that I'm really grateful for about my continued involvement in the student experience work is that I have had the opportunity to think about how we might create a network of folks who are interested in doing this work and democratize access to the resources, to people, to information, and to building community so that we can do it. And so tentatively calling it Student Experience Network right now, but hopefully in the next 6 months, we will launch a website that will be a place to get information, connect with others, and, you know, and really see organically what that power of community and relationship can do as we move towards these larger goals.
I'm working with a colleague who's been a guest in this series, Peter Felton at Elon University, to create a network that we call the Global Forum for Student Success, which is, but it's international, and which includes obviously Americans like you and me. There's a lot of affinity here. You've obviously shown that at your three institutions that one person working with others in relationships can make a difference. And I'm confident that we're going to see more of this, all the more reason for people to follow up with you. I've said this before in a couple of my conversations with others, but I would want anybody to know that I do provide a list of questions to my guests in advance that I'm assuming I may ask. And I provided Dr. Bartell with 18 questions, and I just lost track. We hardly covered any of them. And that I am struck with how organically this conversation developed, and you just gave me so much rich material that was much more important than the stuff that I thought I was going to ask you about. I mean, it's related to where I wanted to go, but you really moved this conversation in the directions that your thinking and your experiences and your, as you said to us, your the integration of the personal with the professional has moved your innovation, and that it does, as you've said, have everything to do with being human. And so you've really talked your walk of your own journey here. And I want to thank you on behalf of our listeners. I can thank you directly now. They're going to have to make more of an effort to thank you, but I hope they will. Okay. So, Denise, just as my accountant said to me years ago when I proposed to him a really stupid investment, he said, "John, stick with what you know." So, Denise, stick with what you know. Okay?
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for Office Hours with John Gardner. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Gardner Institute, and we wish to thank our guests and the entire team who make this podcast possible.